How powerful is the Cox Network? So powerful that one day, the internet will let your doctor perform miracles from thousands of miles away.
Connecting to remote operating room.
Giving a whole new meaning to the term house call.
Operation complete.
The Cox Network. With gig speeds everywhere, it's internet built for tomorrow, today. Cox, bringing us closer. In Cox serviceable areas, speeds vary and are not guaranteed. Cox terms apply. Other restrictions may apply.
We made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
"It's time to switch."
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA. What you're made of, we're made for. Restrictions apply.
Hola, soy Hanna Fernández, divulgadora especializada en bienestar y descanso y autora del libro Aprende a Descansar. Quiero darte la bienvenida a un nuevo episodio de mi programa de podcast A Guide to Live Well, una guía práctica de bienestar en la que descubrirás de la mano de los mayores expertos cómo cuidar tu salud y tu entorno para vivir más y vivir mejor. The role of fasting and fasting mimicking diet in the prevention and treatment of cancer is no longer a taboo subject. On the contrary, it seems that both strategies have a positive impact in the performance of many types of anti-tumor therapies, unlike the vast majority of drugs that, by definition, are specific and in principle only work on a special type of tumor and in a certain stage. Professor Walter Longo is one of those professionals who is aware of the shortcomings and limitations of modern medicine. Professor Longo is a biochemist who has been researching about aging and longevity for 30 years and about tumors for 15 years. He is director and professor at the Longevity Institute in the School of Gerontology at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. He has published in the most important scientific journals such as Nature, Science, and Cell. And in 2018, Time magazine included him in the list of the 50 most influential people in the world in the field of health. Perhaps this continues to be the case in many professionals due to the conspiracy without conspirators that Professor Longo talks about in his new book, Fasting Cancer. Too many economic interests from different industries that prefer chronically ill patients to healthy population. Fasting is not the panacea or a remedy for all diseases, despite the fact that many gurus sell the benefits of fasting as the solution for everything. It is not so, and my guest is very honest. The clinical response, when there is one, varies from one type of tumor to another. But it is a really promising tool.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome, Professor Longo, and thank you very much for accepting the invitation to this podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
We're going to start talking about aging because in your book, you say that aging is one of the main factors to develop tumor cells. And I wanted to know if it is even more important than genetics, more important than healthy habits. Is it more important, aging, than all other factors?
It's more important than everything beside genetics, right?
Yeah.
So, for example, I always show a slide where alcohol and obesity and smoke are the major risk factor for cancer. And then I show next slide how it compares to 30 years of aging and the obesity, alcohol, and smoke disappear. Aging is so much more powerful that you almost can't see it. Genetics is very different because a mouse lives 2.5 years and gets cancer starting at about 1.5 years of age. And people almost never get cancer before, say, 30, 35. So that tells you that the genetics can be completely or nearly completely in charge of when and if you get cancer. For example, these little people in Ecuador that we follow, they have mutation in the growth hormone receptor, almost never get cancer. And the mice that have the same mutation get a lot less cancer, right? So that tells you that genetics could be so powerful to potentially completely prevent cancer. And in fact, we know that some families and centenarians most of the times have very little cancer in the family, right? So somehow they're genetically predisposed to go through life and not get cancer.
But I have the question then, how can we prevent something, in this case cancer, that depends on something we cannot avoid, which is aging? How is this possible?
Well, if we're talking, I mean, in the prevention level, we just have to slow down aging, right? So, and if somebody specifically has a lot of cancer in the family, let's say maybe because of genetic reasons, then I think, you know, you have to go after, maybe go after it more aggressively, right? And say, I know that cancer is very common in this family, so we go specifically against aging and cancer, not just aging. I think in general, we don't like it to try to prevent cancer. We say it's pointless. You can prevent cancer and increase diabetes, or you can prevent cancer and increase Alzheimer's. It doesn't make any sense. Or you want to make somebody live longer, healthier. That's the idea that we push. But then, yeah, if somebody has a lot of cancer in the family, then you have to target that much more carefully. And so do all the things that are necessary, maybe even more extreme than somebody else, because you know that, you know, so... For example, we now started a trial in southern Italy on BRCA mutation, the ones that Angelina Jolie has, and she got a mastectomy because of it. Right? So if somebody is in that category and refuse the mastectomy, let's say, or don't want to get the mastectomy, then you have to be very aggressive, right? Very aggressive. And that's what we're doing in this trial in southern Italy. We'll see what happens, but the nutritional intervention had to be very, very strong because it's going to be a tough one to fight.
You know? Mm-hmm. In fact, you say in your book that more than talking about prevention, we have to talk about lifespan and expanding our lifespan, which are the years that we keep our youth condition. I don't know how to say it, but the years that we are young. So how can we expand our lifespan, taking into account that we have to age and it is something we cannot avoid?
Yes, so we talk more about youth span and health span than lifespan, right? So youth span would be, and that's something that I actually introduced some years ago, gerontology and youth span. So the idea is, how long can you keep somebody young, right? So let's say now most people will agree that we stay young for 40, 45 years. Well, is it possible to make the 45 years 60, 65? And we were starting to move in that direction. Now you hear people saying, you know, the 40-year-old of 100 years ago looks like a 60-year-old of now, right? So we're moving in that direction, at least for some people. But yeah, so then youth span and then health span. Health span is then, if you consider the entire lifespan, how much of that is healthy living versus, you know, living on multiple drugs and now in multiple chronic diseases? Now, for example, in the United States, but Europe is very close to it, the typical health of the 45-year-olds will have two or more chronic diseases. And by age 65, 80% of the 65-year-olds will have two or more chronic conditions or diseases, right? So that's not health span, that's lifespan sick, right? Mm-hmm. So it's sick span, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, I always say that it doesn't make any sense to live more years if you're going to live those years with a very poor quality of life. So this big market that we are seeing now, how it is boosting and growing about longevity, but it is not just giving more years to our life, but giving more quality to those years that we are going to live more, right?
Yes, I think the Citibank did some projections, and they were looking at right now the incredible amount of money that we spend on sick care. Right, you're sick, and then we spend lots of money. And they were projecting 20 years from now, it's going to turn around. So we're going to spend most of the money trying to keep you away from the hospital and away from drugs, right? It's really remarkable. So right now, in a sense, we're in the hands of drug companies. And, you know, maybe being sick is not so bad, right? A lot of people make money from it, right? But I think if the money making can be turned into, if you stay healthy, I make more money, you know, not me, but say a lot of companies. And that's what's happening now. Now, the insurance companies, for example, are starting to turn in that direction, saying, I make more money if you don't get sick, right? So now the insurance company, for the first time ever, they're starting to become aligned with the patients. And that's what we want, right? That's when I think we're going to see big changes. And I think that the medical team of tomorrow is going to have a doctor, is going to have a molecular biologist, is going to have a nutritionist, is going to have a psychologist. And their success is going to be, let's keep you away from hospitals, right? You should never enter a hospital. And if you do, you're going to go in and out, and that's it, right? So very quickly and for very few weeks in your life, you know.
Is what you say in the book that we are living under this conspiracy without conspirators?
Yeah, I call it an unconspired conspiracy. So it's like nobody's sitting around saying, I want everybody to be sick. I want everybody to, you know, be a lot of drugs. Even the drug, you know, I know a lot of people work for and maybe even lead drug companies. And they're trying to do good. You know, their feeling is like, I want to do drugs because I want to help people. Yes, but the reality is that, in fact, you know, it's just not a bad deal that everybody's sick. You know, the food company make a lot of money. The drug company made a lot of money. The hospitals that are private, they make a lot of money. It's just hard to think of somebody not making money from sick people, you know, beside nonprofit organizations. And this is something that Marion Nestle recently was telling me, and she's an expert in this field. You know, so that was her statement. You know, it's hard to think of anybody that doesn't make money from this very bad food, everyone is sick modality. You know? Mm-hmm.
Going back to the idea of aging as a risk factor, I wanted to know, I imagine it has to be very frustrating for you if we talk about child cancer or cancer suffer in very young people, because in these cases, there is no aging at all or almost no aging, but they are developing this kind of illnesses. So how do you manage? I don't know if you have had any study regarding this or...
We've been trying for 20 years now. You know, this is one of the first things we wanted to do back nearly 20 years ago, or actually more than 20 years ago in Los Angeles at the Children's Hospital. And because, you know, oncologists are worried about changing diet and certainly fasting, even for adults. And everybody's very scared to do this in children now. So now I think we're about to do it because now we have so many clinical trials in adults that I think that hopefully very soon a pediatric oncologist is going to be motivated enough to do this in children. But so far, even after many, many, many meetings with pediatric oncologists, we never started a clinical trial on fasting, mimicking diet, and cancer in children.
Mm-hmm. You have said that there are some oncologists, not many, that are starting to talk about changing diet of patients. Before starting the interview, I told you that I had a case in my family, my brother-in-law diet. And when we suggested him to maybe try changing the way you eat, because he was not eating very healthy, and he asked his oncologist, and she just said, you can eat whatever you want, you can drink whatever you want, because diet does not affect the development and the evolution of your disease. And I think this is something, and you say it also in the book very clearly, that the conversation has to change. And it is oncologists who need to to stop about thinking, sorry, to stop about saying you can do anything you want because this is something that goes for free and start doing something, in this case, related to eating.
Yeah, I think that, you know, maybe 15, 20 years ago, that was justifiable, right? That viewing food and as what could it possibly do to a cancer cell. Now we have tens of conferences. I just came here and presented a couple months ago in Madrid in CNIO, the leading cancer institute in Spain, organized a conference on nutrition and cancer, right? So and there I had the some of the leading people from all over the world, MIT, and many, many top centers. So now I think to most world-class experts on cancer, saying that nutrition doesn't matter or metabolism doesn't matter in cancer treatment is, it just shows, you know, very naive understanding of cancer. So cancer, you know, at the center of cancer growth are nutrients, right? And the more interesting thing is that cancer eats very differently or often very differently from a normal cells. So almost every cancer that you look at will have a sort of an obsession for one amino acid or the other. I mean, it literally depends on having lots of one amino acid or lots of sugar, right? And it keeps on changing. But it, what's common is it's always nutrients and factors or growth factors, which are directly controlled by nutrients. So then of course, these type of arguments are old fashioned. We are seeing the newly trained oncologists moving in a very different direction. And I think it's up to the patient. So we don't want to take the power away from oncologists. I wrote my book with lots of oncologists. I think it's 15 oncologists. Every chapter was read and carefully reviewed by an oncologist. So it's not about to take the power away from that. It's about helping them. And they have to say, maybe I don't know enough about everything, you know, and maybe I need the help of a team, and maybe I need the molecular biologist and the nutritionist and the psychologist, and that's how we're going to treat this patient. And, you know, and it's up to the patient to now say, this is it. Now I want the team, you know, this is not enough anymore. I want that team, and I want that team. You know, I started the book by talking about Los Angeles and following a fire truck and realizing that the fire truck, the ambulance, the police cars were all going to a place where somebody fell off a bike, you know. And I thought, look how much money the U.S. government spends on somebody that just fell off a bike. And they knew he fell off a bike. It wasn't, he got in an accident with a car, but still. And then I thought, now imagine the person, and I hear this every day, they got cancer, they go to an oncologist, they spend 30 minutes with the oncologist, and that's it. Then they go back home and look on the internet and hope that to find something that will help them beat the disease, right? So, yeah, unacceptable. So the patient should say, okay, maybe I should look for another oncologist, right? And one that is more prepared and able to work in an interdisciplinary team and do better. You know? Mm-hmm.
You have just mentioned that tumor cells eat. And that's something people do not think about. But what we eat is the feed that we give and the food that we give to the tumor cells. So, and in fact, in the book, you say that the tumor cells are not the fool ones, are not stupid, are not the smart ones, but you say that they are confused. And the question is, what do these cells eat? And you, specifically, I would like you to speak, please, about glucose and proteins, because now we are in the era of eating protein, because we need protein to build muscle. What do we do with proteins, with glucose, and how is it that these cells eat these two important nutrients?
Yeah, so we started this in cancer maybe 15 years ago, and the idea was that we noticed in simple organisms that the protection, cellular protection, dependent on lowering these genes called RAS, or the activity of these, the product of the genes called RAS, PKI, AKT, etc. So this is a technical term, but what does it mean? It means that we realize that oncogenes, the genes that are mutated in all cancer cells, they are preventing any cancer cell from becoming protected. So what does it mean? It means that if you starve a system, all the cells in the body, in a very coordinated, very sophisticated way, they recognize the starvation and they know exactly what to do. And not only do they know what to do for a few days, they know what to do for months, right? So the average person can go 1 or 2 months with no food. That doesn't mean we recommend this, but that if necessary, that's what people can do. So now the cancer cell instead has lost this ability to do that. And it basically is it's a sort of like a dumb program saying, I don't care what's happening out there. I want to keep eating. All I know what to do is to keep eating. And I need lots of proteins, lots of amino acids that come from the proteins, lots of sugar. Sometimes I need lots of fats, right? So I need a lot of everything. And I may need a lot of IGF-1 and insulin and so and on and on and on, right? So then what we want to do, independently of the sophistication of the cancer therapy, immunotherapy, hormone therapy, so we're saying absolutely, right? We almost never cured any mice with just fasting, right? But we almost never cured any mice with just any therapy, right? Immunotherapy included. We could never cure a single cancer with immunotherapy, right? When you put them together, now all of a sudden you see just an incredible what's called synergistic effect, right? So yeah, then the cancer cell, as you starve the patient or the mouse, is starting to struggle. It just doesn't get enough in the form of energy, but also in the form of building blocks. So the cancer cells to divide, they need a lot of bricks, let's say. And these bricks come from fats, carbohydrates, and proteins. So if they don't have it, they become very weak. And that's when you want to hit them with the chemo, the radiation, the kinase inhibitor, the hormone therapy, the immunotherapy, et cetera, et cetera.
So to understand it, healthy cells have the mechanism to protect themselves when there is no food. But tumor cells do not have this mechanism. That's the idea under all your work.
Right. Yes, yes. And so I always use an analogy, which I also use in the book. So imagine I send 1 billion people in the desert, right? And imagine I send 1 billion people and I put them in the shade and I tell them to sit down and drink a lot, right? You go 2 weeks later, almost every one of the 1 billion people is still alive, okay? Now imagine first of all, make them run all the time. And that already is going to be a big, big problem. And that's what cancer cells do, right? They cannot stop running. Then you keep the sun, you don't put the shade, and that's the chemotherapy, the immunotherapy, the radiation, et cetera, et cetera. And then you take away the water, right? Well, if you think about that, you go back 2 weeks later, how many of the 1 billion people that have been running under the sun with no water, how many are going to be alive? Zero, right? And I mean, it's really remarkable to say, is it possible that out of 1 billion people, you kill 1 billion people? Yes. And the one factor, and if you give them a lot of water, maybe 2 or 3 million, whatever, I'm just throwing out numbers, will survive, right? So if they're running under the sun, but you just follow them with lots of water, like they do in the cancer hospitals, right? Oh, eat, you know, because you're losing weight, you know, so keep eating. Well, so we're following that person running in the desert under the sun with water, and a lot of them are going to make it, right? And that's exactly what the cancer cells want, you know, to be followed with lots of food, you know, lots of amino acids. And the normal cells are basically saying, I could do without it. I'm okay with it. I know exactly what to do without any of it. And I'll survive. And I won't survive forever, but I'll survive for a very long time.
You have just mentioned one urban legend, I don't know, or a fairy tale, I don't know how to say it, but something that ill people are told, which is eat a lot because you have to heal. Is something similar like what you hear that people say to pregnant women, you have to eat twice because you have to feed two bodies. But on the contrary, the theory you explain in your book is that you can starve tumor cells without starving the patient and without affecting and without damaging important systems such as the immune system and the nervous system. How do you do that? How is it possible to starve a cell but not starve the patient?
Yeah, so we've been doing it for a long time, and we've been doing it with the team, right? And so the oncologist has to be collaborating, and we have the molecular biologist, the dietitian. And so we follow the patient, and we basically try to keep the muscle mass the same, and we do it by making them do weight training. So we have a little video that we make available at the foundation clinic. We make available to the cancer patients. So they do about 20 minutes of weight training per day. Very light, very easy, and most were able to do it. And so, you know, in some of our publications, we actually showed the effect of that. And so they were, you know, easily able to maintain muscle mass. And unfortunately, even in the clinical trials, we faced not so much the oncologists. The oncologists were okay with... I think the oncologists oftentimes understand more the need to kill all the cancer cells, whatever it takes, right? But it was the physicians that were worried about the weight of the patient that were the biggest problem, because they basically say, no, you have to give the patient 1.5 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight per day, animal proteins. And we're saying, no, don't do this, you know, because... you're going to help the cancer cells way more than anything else. And, you know, sure enough, what happened is a lot of the women that were doing that, they were gaining lean body mass. And we thought it was crazy because we're not here to make Schwarzenegger women. We're trying to make them keep the muscle mass and cure the cancer, right? It made no sense. But believe it or not, we lost that fight. Again, not against the oncologist, because the oncologist were like, I'm fine. If you think it's going to hurt more the cancer cells if you go that way, do it. And but the physicians in the hospitals, and this has happens in lots of places, they're basically different silos, right? So they'll be in the silos of, I don't care about the cancer. Well, it's not that they don't care about the cancer, but my job is to keep the patient with a healthy weight. And then you do your job, and the oncologist does his job or her job, but it's my job, right? Now, we got to move into, you know, you got to get all the cancer cells and make sure that in the process you don't kill the patient, right? So that's a very difficult thing to do, and that's why that team very closely following every step is necessary. Hmm.
In the book, you speak about the different functions of fasting. One of them, for sure, is to reduce or to weaken tumor cells. But another one, very important one, is to promote the production of immune cells, which are essential to battle against tumor cells, right?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's interesting that if we go back 20, 25 years, the same criticism that we're getting and we've been getting for the past 10 years, the immunotherapy people got, right? Because people are like, oh, come on, you know, with the immune system now is going to attack the cancer cells. That's a stupid idea, right? And so it's entertaining. You know, so eventually now immunotherapy is the number one, I think, treatment for cancer. So it doesn't look so much that although we published on that, it doesn't look so much like the fasting and refeeding cycle are helping the immune system. It looks more, although it seems that they do, but it looks more like they're making the cancer cell much more visible as a foreign entity, right? So they're turning the cancer cell. So it's almost like saying, well, immune system, if you had any doubt of whether this was a good cell or a bad cell, it's bad. Attack it, right? And so we very clearly showed that for years in mice. And now Claudio Vernieri and other at the Italian National Cancer Institute have started to show this in lots of different cancers. So they see the infiltration of T cells in the tumor, no matter what the tumor is, in lots of different tumors. And more so now, they just recently published And this was a trial with 100 patients. And then they published a follow-up with 5 patients that had advanced stage lethal cancers. And they reported in the European Journal of Cancer, I think it was, exceptional responses in, you know, pancreatic cancer, colorectal cancer, lung cancer, breast cancer. So probably the immune system is playing a role, right? So probably now you made an antigen out of all these cancer cells, or maybe you made many antigens, kind of like, you know, if you think about COVID, well, you can have or the flu, right? You can have one, or you can have many catching all the variety of flu viruses that could attack you. And so maybe that's what's happening, that we're creating lots of antigens and lots of immune responses to them. And that's why we're now seeing this, surprising, cancer-free or no evidence of cancer survival.
I know the following question is a difficult one because it is not an A or B answer, I know, but I have to ask, what kind of fasting strategy is the right one? Because we listen about the physiological fasting of 12 hours. That's the one I do, 12, 14 hours. But we also listen, if you go to social media, internet, I know it's not the right source, but if you go to social media and internet, you can find a lot of people that say, I'm on a 24-hour fasting and I do just one meal a day and I'm fantastic and I feel full of energy and I'm super healthy. There are other people that do like 5-day water fasting. What does science say about these different strategies? And is it really a good one, a bad one? All of them are fine, depending on who is following them. So,
yeah. So I think, Greenspan years ago in the United States called the behavior as irrational exuberance, right? And this had to do with people, buying homes and other financial operations. So I always say fasting doesn't mean anything, right? Fasting is like eating. So is eating good for you? Well, it's good, it's neutral, and it's bad, right? So fasting is the same way. So it's a question of who does what, right? And for how long. And so I think we need to move away from words like intermittent fasting or fasting and move into, okay, what problem do you have? Well, one problem we all share is aging, right? Okay, we're going to address aging in a relatively healthy person. Then I think we examine, as we've done for when I wrote the book, The Longevity Diet, you do 5 pillars, right? So you say, well, what if we put the clinical studies, the basic research in mice and cells, the epidemiological studies, and then we look at centenarians, and then we look at, how planes and cars age, and we put it all together, we get a pretty clear picture of probably you need to do this. And some of the things we say, maybe don't do it because we're not sure, but we're sure about this common denominator. Yeah, so that's what people should do. And I think if you do that with fasting, a couple of things emerge. One, you should not do 16 hours of fasting, particularly if it involves skipping breakfast. Why? Many, many studies now associating breakfast skipping with increased mortality, increased cardiovascular disease, slowing down on metabolism, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
So, is it true that when you do 16 hours, you get a lot of benefits? Absolutely. I say, people that did the cocaine also get a lot of benefits, right? So just because you get benefits from something, it means absolutely nothing in the long run, right? So yeah, you could do some things that is very good for you. So for example, if you inject yourself with insulin, and let's say we go back 50 years, and when insulin biology was discovered. So you could say, insulin is great. Let me inject myself with insulin. And of course, a lot of people, diabetics, et cetera, did. Well, you could conclude that insulin injections are the future, right? Oh, your glucose level drop. You feel, you know, energetic, but you're very healthy. That's true until you develop insulin resistance. And then that gives you diabetes and that gives you obesity too, right? So it makes you obese in the long run and diabetic. And yet it's such a great, drug or protein. So then, yeah, we need to understand 16 hours, for example, not good because in the long run, it makes you live shorter. 12 hours and also gallstone formation, right? The 16 hours is associated with the stones that form in your gallbladder. 12 hours instead, I always say, I've never seen a negative study, right? So there's Sachin Panda and others have done studies that show that if you go from eating for 15, 16 hours a day down to 12 or 11, you get lots of benefits. And so that to me is a very good, you know, compromise, right? You may not get as big benefits as the 16 hours short term, but you certainly don't have any long-term problems and you seem to have a lot of long-term benefits, right? So 8 a.m., 8 p.m., you eat. 8 p.m., 8 a.m., you don't eat or 9 or whatever. Doesn't matter, you know, as long as you keep as regular as possible. The number two is the fasting mimicking diet, right? And so we came up with that, but people think that we came up with that, you know, like Ansel Keys came up with the Mediterranean diet. That's not the case, right? We came up with it because I was a student of Roy Walford 30 years ago. And basically, I saw the incredible effects of calorie restriction on him and lots of other people. Now, people can go read the books to learn about the stories. But then I saw the incredible problems that caused. They looked like, you know, a skeleton. They were very miserable, et cetera, et cetera. And so I said, well, is it possible that there is a way to maintain all these incredible benefits on cholesterol, blood pressure, fasting glucose, you know, maybe cancer prevention, et cetera, et cetera. This was later shown for monkeys, but without making people miserable and looking like a skeleton. And so that's where the fasting mimicking diet done maybe 3 or 4 times a year comes from. And so this is a 5-day low calorie, you know, 1100 going to 800 calories lasting 5 days, and high fat, plant-based, high fat, low sugar, low protein diet. And so now we have lots of data in mice, but also lots of data in people. And it looks very promising as a way to slow down aging and prevent cancer. So those are my two of my favorites. The third one is skipping lunch, which I've been doing for 20 years. And I don't do it all the time, but now we're starting a large trial, 500 patients in Southern Italy, where we're going to introduce for the first time this concept of lunch skipping in the what I call the longevity diet. So you have breakfast, you have dinner, maybe you have a snack in the afternoon, and then you either have no lunch or have like 100 calorie healthy snack for lunch. And I've been using it. Lots of patients we follow at our clinics use it. But we'll see. We haven't formally demonstrated that it works yet.
Mm-hmm. Regarding what to eat, the ideal diet, do you describe it, what I think is the longevity diet, as a low but enough protein diet? And the question is, how much is it enough protein? Because this is something like, depending on the source you ask or you see, you get so much, so different information. So what is enough protein, healthy protein for people who play sport, who go every day to work for 8 or more hours, who have a family, who have a lot of things to do? So they are not just like these sedentary, so for active people, how much is it enough protein?
Yeah. So first of all, I think that, you know, so we have a foundation nonprofit clinic in Milan. We have one in Los Angeles. I hope that at some point we'll have one in Spain soon enough. So, and the point is, you probably should talk to somebody that understands you, your blood test, et cetera, and says, this is enough protein for you. Also because if you look at there are already at least three age ranges where that changes, right? So we published years ago, almost 10 years ago now, that Americans had a very low protein diet, so less than 10% of calories coming from protein. They did incredibly well for cancer and overall mortality up to age 65. If they did that up to age 65, then the follow-up was later. But you know, the eating behavior was, say, up to age 65. But then they didn't do so well if they're eating a very low protein diet when they were 70, 80, 90 years old, right? So yeah, so that tells you that there are different. So the 0 to 20, they're going to need a level of proteins. And there's not very much protein. We wrote a book actually about children and show that most children in Italy, but I think it's the same in Spain and the United States, eat 2 to 4 times more proteins than recommended by all the American pediatric association of most countries. So it's really getting out of control. And it could be the reason why we're starting to see cancers in the 20-year-olds, the 30-year-olds, right? Now, these are the population that are coming out of this crazy protein abuse. So then the right amount, it's about 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight per day. So if you up to age 65, 70, and then it goes up a little bit. So, but it also depends what kind of proteins you're eating, right? So if you're having a normal, let's say, Mediterranean diet, then it's about 0.8. So that means that if you weigh 70 pounds, that's about 60 grams of proteins per day. Okay. And you know, most things now have, they tell you how much protein, but again, it gets a little tricky because most people might go to calculate the proteins in a steak or in chicken, and they don't go calculate the proteins in the pasta. They don't go in the cereal that they eat and in the eggs. So there in the almonds. So there's proteins everywhere, right? So you might have, yes, you might have 60. I was just talking to my nephew the other day, and he was like, oh, I only have 60 grams of proteins. Then when we start calculating, he had about 100, right? Because he was not calculating everything else that contains protein. So yeah, so that's the level that for most people is okay. But let's say that you're now a vegan. I just got an email from Simon Hill, who's a famous podcaster in Australia. And he, I hope I can say this, Simon, if somehow you get a hold of this.
I hope Simon listens to this podcast.
Yeah, exactly. but so he does 1.5 grams of protein per day, per kilogram per day. And his IGF-1 is actually fairly low, right? But it's all vegan. He's 100% vegan, right? So yeah, so that tells you, so we know that, for example, some amino acids like methionine and cysteine, they could be 1/4, 1/5 between two different foods, right? So the legumes have very low levels of some amino acids, and the fish, for example, may have very high levels. So both healthy, but one has got 4 or 5 times. So somebody that eats fish once a week or meat once a week is going to be very, very different from ones that eat fish or meat 5, 6 times a week, right? And this, you see now it's getting complicated, right? But, and I understand that the journalists say, well, it's too complicated, but okay, I hope that with interviews like this, we steer you in the right direction. But then you say, okay, I realize this is not as easy as I thought. Maybe I should find, and again, don't go find anybody, right? I mean, I always say if you needed knee surgery, you wouldn't just say to your friend, you know how to do it? You think you can operate on my knee? Or because he or she read a lot of books on knee surgery, right? This would be crazy by anybody. But that's exactly what we do with nutrition, right? We think that because a podcaster or somebody, you know, has got a loud enough voice, and they read a lot of papers, they can go, it just seems so complicated, we cannot even begin to explain it, right? So we can explain it, of course, but to intervene the right way, it is a lot of back and forth. And so it takes us an average of 2 to 3 years to take somebody from a bad shape in the clinic and bring them back to a very healthy status. Mm-hmm. You know?
Talking about protein and veganism, I have to ask you about the keto diet, because it's like a eating strategy that now is like the panacea for everything. But I know there are, I don't have the data in my mind, but I think I've read that keto diet is right for the treatment of some kind of patients, cancer patients. But the thing is, how do we combine the theory of fasting and fasting mimicking diet with the keto diet, which is restricting carbs, which is something that tumor cells eat? So how do we combine all these theories? Because keto diet is mainly fat and protein from an origin, animal origin, animal sources.
Yeah. So first of all, I would say be very careful and don't do the keto diet if you're healthy, because it's going to get benefits again short term. And in the long run, it's very clear, particularly if it's animal based, it's going to kill you earlier, right? Or much earlier. And this is lots of epidemiological study, Harvard study, Lancet meta-analysis, very clear, right? The people that are on low carbohydrate or very low carbohydrate diet, unless they're vegan-based and they're moderate, right? So if you have a 40% carbohydrate diet and it's mostly vegan, those seem to do extremely well. But the typical keto low-carb diets have a lot of animal fats and proteins. They seem to do very poorly. Then you look at cancer, and it gets very tricky. That's why probably not such a good idea in general to go the keto way. Why? Because some cancers hate the low carb environment and high fat and high protein, and many cancers love it, right? And they can be fueled by high fat and high protein. So if you happen to have, and it doesn't even have, you could even have the same cancer that contains both cells that love it and they hate it, and you still got a problem, right? Because you're going to deplete the ones that hate it, and then the ones that love it are going to grow, take over, and the patient is still going to die. So this is why we're saying, you know, the fasting-mimicking diet is a ketogenic diet, right? It's a diet that is high in fat, and it causes ketone bodies to go up, but it's a ketogenic plus. Well, it's ketogenic, it's low sugar, it's low amino acids, it's low protein, so it's going to make it difficult. And this is why now there's probably over 50 papers in animals, and it keeps on working no matter what cancer you, and I'm sure somebody's going to show that it doesn't work for a particular cancer. But in combination with the whatever therapy, it just keeps on making whatever therapy much better, right? And in this, like, for example, when we tested it with hormone therapy, breast cancer and hormone therapy, we realized, so we use fulvestrant, which blocks the estrogen signaling, and palbociclib, which blocks the CDK4/6, right? And which is standard of care for women with breast cancer. So if you do this in a mouse, it works very well. It keep the cell not growing for a while, and then they become resistant. Now, if you add the fasting-mimicking diet, they just go the other way around, right? They start going down, and the mice start becoming cancer-free. And when we look at it, it turned out that it was lowering insulin, lowering IGF-1, and lowering leptin. All three were required. So now you have two drugs plus three different factors affected by the FMD. And that's why we call it the wild card, right? So now let's say that instead of the fasting mimicking diet, you use a ketogenic diet. Very unlikely the insulin, IGF-1, and leptin are all lowered. Possible, depending on the situation. So possible, but very unlikely. And so now you will have a problem because, you know, the cancer will get around and then start growing, right? So, this is why we're saying 5 days of a fasting-mimicking diet and then back to a longevity diet. This is what we've done for thousands of patients in the clinics. And we think that that's probably the best way to go, paying a lot of attention to muscle mass, bone density, you know, patient health, you know, so making sure that the patient doesn't lose weight, doesn't lose muscle mass. Yeah.
So for healthy people, in terms of prevention, would it be right to recommend or to follow a 5-day fasting mimicking diet protocol, I don't know, twice a year, once per season? How do you do it yourself? Because I suppose you follow it yourself.
So I don't eat lunch most of the times. Sometimes I do, but most of the times I don't. And I follow a longevity diet. I really follow it. So I eat like that. And so I do it maybe once or twice a year. But I would say most people probably 2 to 3 times a year, they're healthy. And then, for example, we just finished, we in the sense of hospital, I was included in the papers, but it's not my study. But sorry, University of Heidelberg just published on diabetes and fasting mimicking diet, 6 cycles. In fact, against the cycles of the Mediterranean diet. And, you know, the fasting mimicking diet worked very well in, and not the Mediterranean cycles, in, causing regression and lowering of the drugs. But that was once a month because they were diabetic, you know, mostly, say, obese or overweight and diabetic. And now University of Leiden finished a larger trial with 100 patients where they did it once a month for 12 months. But even in these scenarios, I think that the idea is you start with, let's say, 1 cycle a month in an obese diabetic person for a year. Then maybe after a year, you move it to once every 2 months. And then after, 2 years, you move it to once every 3 months. And yeah, so I think that that's the idea. Yeah, it's a little tough, but if you consider we don't change their exercise regimen and we don't change their eating habits, we just say it's a box, you take it, you do it, and then you go back to whatever it is that you do. You know, and so, yeah, I think we see that for health, for the overall population has been a very good way to move forward. I don't make a penny out of any of this. You know, I donate and dedicate everything to the foundation or to research, et cetera. But I think it's, considering this FDA world we live in, you know, we can't be just advising, oh, go home and cook it up and good luck to you, you know. And we tried that, and I think it was overall, it was a failure, both with cancer patient and with the general population.
Mm-hmm. I have 2 more questions, Professor Longo. One of them is, the main audience of this podcast is female, so I know for sure you cannot give a general recommendation in terms of what to eat or what not to eat, not for healthy people, not for people suffering a disease such as cancer, because cancer is not just one disease, it's more than 100 diseases because cell cancers are so different. But if you could give us a recommendation of, I don't know, 1-2 things to not to eat in order to prevent, and 1-2 things to eat in order to prevent the development of cancer for women, talking about breast cancer and gynecologic cancer, what those things would be?
Yeah. I will say, try to, instead of giving you 1 or 2 things, red meat is by far, and now even the World Health Organization puts it as a risk factor for cancer. So, but I would say try to get as close as possible to a pescatarian, relatively low protein, but sufficient protein pescatarian diet. Say fish 3 times a week, maybe a few eggs a week, and then vegan. And that's already sums up a very healthy diet, right? And watch for the mercury. So lots of fish
are loaded with mercury. Fish. Yeah.
So you have to, maybe go more with the anchovies, maybe salmon once a week, and some other low mercury fish, maybe another once a week, and seafood. But I think, in general, that's a very good way to do it. And it's self-regulatory. So it's very difficult to have excess amino acids by a vegan diet, almost impossible, because you will have to eat pounds and pounds of it. But it's easier to get malnourished with a vegan diet. And so this is why we're saying probably fish and a few eggs a week. So fish 3 times a week and a few eggs, and then a vegan diet as organic as possible. And that already should be very, very helpful and maybe life-changing to most people that may be at risk for cancer.
And the final question, the studies you referred to in the book describe mainly the experience you have with mice, with animals. Of course, there are cases of real people that you have worked with and very successful and hopeful stories. But the thing is, the results are mainly in mice. I know you need a lot of money, a lot of research. I mean, it's not your fault, it's the situation. But when do you think we will have big data regarding humans?
Actually, I hate to disagree, But
no,
if
course,
you think of the number of patients that are in that book, is a table at the end, a list, it probably more patient tested than mice. If you take all these animal studies that have looked at fasting, mimicking diet and fasting, and then you compare it with the number of patients, we probably see more patients than mice. So patients probably over, 500, 600, many different type of cancers. So I'm not sure if there are 600 mice studied in this list, 50 studies, Yeah, maybe there are, but I'm saying that if anything, they're comparable. So what's missing? Well, it's missing lots of trials with lots of cancers. And so we encourage, just like today, I got another request by, I forgot, Ohio or Indiana. So almost every day we get a hospital from all over the world they want to do a trial. I think the latest one was on ovarian cancer. And yeah, absolutely. So the more the merrier. People, the hospitals and universities that have funds or they can sort of, the company gives it for free. Right, gives the hospital the diet for free. So feel free to contact us and we'll just help any hospital do the study. And again, it's just two arms, usually one with the FMD and one without it. So to the hospital, if they have goodwill, they don't even need to have funds. It costs them exactly the same. But in some cases, they want to have funds and, the success rate has been pretty high on hospitals getting funding for this, right? So yeah, absolutely. But again, don't forget that now many trials have been finished on fasting and fasting mimicking diets. Almost all of them are positive. They're not conclusive, but some of them are fairly large, 125 patients and 100 patients. So at least three are over 100 patients per trial. And so I think that we also want to fight this mentality of it's either FDA approved or you don't do it. Okay. So we if you're a patient, particularly one that goes to the oncologist and the oncologist says, it's not looking good. You're not responding. Okay. That's when you want to say, I understand that, let's say I have breast cancer. Well, I understand that, there is no proof that fasting mimicking diet will make hormone therapy better for me, but I'm becoming resistant to hormone therapy, and the mouse study and the initial cases on hormone therapy and FMD are looking really good, So what's the damage of adding it? None, right? None. It's just like you're a person receiving hormone therapy plus a fasting mimicking diet once a month, just like the diabetes patient. So push the oncologist to sit down, you can contact the foundation, we'll talk to the oncologist, and, let's try to figure out why not, right? Is there a why not? Fine, we're not pushing anybody to do anything. If everybody's in agreement, this could be dangerous because the person is anorexic or has lost a lot of weight or has lost a lot of lean body mass. But I think in general, don't feel like you have to wait another 15 years for the FMD plus your particular therapy and cancer is approved by the FDA, because it may never happen. Things are going so fast. So just last thing I say, so we got 11 of the best hospitals in the world together. Mayo Clinic, MD Anderson, Cleveland Clinic, UCSF, USC. Yeah. And this is now 4 years. 4 years we've been trying to get funding, $13 million from the government, and it keeps coming back negative, right? But the really disturbing part was when we started talking to, and these are some of the best breast oncologists in the world by far. But when we talked to them, they're saying, Walter, even if we do this trial, it's going to take us about 7 years to finish it. And you know what's going to happen? By the time we finish the trial, there's going to be another standard of care. So nobody's going to care about this because I said, you tried the FMD plus fulvestrant and palbociclib, but now there is another drug that everybody's using. So you got to start over. So it's just unless you have $200 or $300 million ready to spend them because you have so much money as a drug company that you don't know how to spend them, it's an impossible. So to respond to what's needed, you know, it's extremely difficult to get what's needed. A, because everybody's in this mentality of drug, drug, drug. So we're even struggling to get the funding for it. But let's say we do get the funding, it doesn't even matter. Because by the time we're done with it, we got to start over. And then who's going to give us more funding to say, oh, you were the guy 7 years ago that wanted to do this. And now you're back and now you want to do it with another set of drugs, right? So yeah, this is the system. It shouldn't be like this, right? Should be a much faster system, much smarter system. But that's the system we live in. And that's why the patient, I think, needs to, you know, get the right oncologist and the right integrative oncologist and the right team and say, okay, within the limits of the FDA, and the FDA says, hey, food, you and the oncologist decide. I don't decide, you know, I don't regulate what kind of food you eat every day. So the FDA is fine with it. So it's up to the oncologist, and it should be working with a dietitian or a nutritionist. And then, hey, no violation of anything. So if it's the case, do it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, the question was not in order to attack your work, for sure. It was more in order to attack the how our society and how industries are working. And also, but sometimes we think if there is not a FDA report or if it is not widespread, is something that is not working. And on the contrary, and that's what I want to say that to the people who are listening to us right now, if you're suffering cancer disease or you have someone near you suffering this disease, don't wait to have a report or a trial on human. Contact Walter Longo Foundation. They will help you.
Yeah, but my point was like we've been doing clinical trials since 2008, right? So there's lots of clinical work. So that you don't go to the oncologist and just saying, oh, Longo works in mice and cells. Oh, I want to do it on myself. Go to the oncologist saying, hey, there are, you know, 10 published clinical trials. And some of them might even be on my cancer. So it seems to be safe. Do we have proof that it's effective? No. But if you oncologists are telling me my treatment is not working and the new one is not likely to work, I would like to try this, right? So, yeah, so it's within your rights. And yeah, so I was just arguing with the because a lot of times we get sort of dismissed as like, oh, the mice, the ratones, is that how you say? Yes, one of my favorite words now, the ratones. And so we get dismissed as like, yeah, you know, they're working on mice. But no, we've been helping the best hospitals in the world do multiple clinical trials. And so that's now year 15, right? 15 years of clinical trials. And that's what I think people should understand. So keep that in mind and make sure the oncologist and we'll be happy, the foundation will be happy to give you the papers so that you can show it to the oncologist and then together make a decision on what's right or not.
And a good way to start is giving your oncologist your book as a gift. I have it here in Spanish. It is El Ayuno Contra el Cáncer. I don't know the title in English. I know Fasting Against Cancer. Fasting Cancer. So the best way, a good way to start is giving the book is amazing. It's a huge work. So congratulations because it is amazing. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you very much for your work. And I hope to have the opportunity to talk to you in the future and have more reports and more data and more proof to speak about cancer. So thank you very much, Walter. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Espero que hayas disfrutado del episodio. Este programa de podcast es independiente y en abierto gracias al apoyo económico de marcas que apuestan por mi trabajo y confían en mí para ayudarles a comunicar su mensaje. Los expertos que aceptan mi invitación a intervenir en este programa no tienen ningún tipo de vinculación con dichas marcas a menos que se especifique lo contrario. Y todo el contenido de mi podcast, página web y redes sociales que haya sido patrocinado irá acreditado como tal. Gracias por ayudarme a que este proyecto siga siendo viable e independiente visitando la web de mis anunciantes, dejando reseñas, comentarios y valoraciones en las distintas plataformas de reproducción y compartiendo mi contenido en tus redes sociales. Mil gracias por estar al otro lado. Nos escuchamos en el próximo episodio.
Powerful is the Cox Network. So powerful that one day the internet will let your doctor perform miracles from thousands of miles away.
Connecting to remote operating room.
Giving a whole new meaning to the term house call.
Operation complete.
The Cox Network, with gig speeds everywhere. It's internet built for tomorrow, today. Cox, bringing us closer. In Cox serviceable areas, speeds vary and are not guaranteed. Cox terms apply. Other restrictions may apply.
We made USAA insurance to help you save. Take advantage of discounts when you cover your home and your ride. Discover how we're helping members save at usaa.com/bundle. USAA. Restrictions apply.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.